My name is Ari Alanis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at New York University, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by Sevane Selassie, a renowned meditation teacher and integral coach based out of New York City. We discuss the role of mindfulness in young people's lives, mindfulness in social justice, and her own event that she was speaking at NYU that night, talking about mindful sex and our relationships to our bodies. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Sevane Selassie, a self-described or friend-described, either way, Dharma nerd, and a integral coach, which we'll talk about more what that means and your work with mindfulness and the Dharma later. And I'm also joined by someone from our office, very special guest today, Rekha Prasad. Rekha, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Rekha. I run the mindfulness programming here at Global Spiritual Life at New York University. Where we do meditation sits, yoga, and big events around mindfulness and the Dharma. And so we are very happy to have Sevane with us. She'll be teaching for us tonight, and along with a lot of other wonderful teachers we get to bring in throughout the year.
Great. And Rekha is going to conclude the session today by leading us in a mindfulness sit. I'm just kidding. you should see the look she just gave me.
Okay, great. So Sevane is a wonderful teacher who's been doing this for quite a while, and so we're so glad that she'll be coming to share her wisdom with our community tonight. So you're affiliated with New York Insight and other meditation spaces, and so I thought we'd just start off by you telling us a little bit about how you came to these practices, what they mean to you, and then we'll go from there.
Great. I came to Buddhism fairly young. I started dabbling in it in high school for high school projects. I was introduced to it because my brother actually became what's known as a Hare Krishna, part of the ISKCON community when I was in high school. And so I got introduced to Eastern thought, to Eastern philosophy and religions, and quickly realized that I was interested in Buddhism particularly. So when I got to school to undergrad, I decided to major in comparative religious studies, and my focus was on early Buddhism. So I had a very kind of academic, intellectual relationship to it for a while, and I didn't actually start practicing in earnest until after I graduated. And I came to meditation and the Dharma as a practice actually through yoga. So I started practicing yoga first, really connecting with my body. I was a pretty disembodied, heady kind of kid and young adult. And I think the more I settled into my body, actually, I was better prepared for meditation, let's say. So I stopped only just reading books about the Dharma and started actually practicing. And when I moved to New York in 1995, I was about 25 years old, I started practicing with a teacher, Barry Magid. Is in the ordinary mind tradition, a Zen tradition, and I practiced mostly in that tradition for a number of years, and then came to the Insight tradition, which is my primary tradition now, about 10 years ago, and started really training in earnest. It was actually around the same time that I got diagnosed with cancer for the first time, and there's nothing like cancer to deepen your meditation practice. So I really started doing more retreats and studying more intensively in this tradition, and then from there entered into teacher training and deepening my practice in that way.
You mentioned being a cancer survivor and how that deepened your practice, and I'm interested because you also mentioned how this was a way to really connect with your body. How do all those things sort of come together?
Yeah, you know, I think some ways, I talk about this a lot, I'll probably mention it tonight, that we did a disservice maybe by calling it mindfulness. There are a lot of great things about that word, especially because before it was used as the translation for sati, for what we translated as mindfulness. Mindfulness didn't really have a big place in the English language, so it's nice that it was sort of a word that didn't have a lot of connotations for us. But it has the word mind at the beginning of it. And that leads us to forget that this practice is actually an embodied presence, the first foundation of mindfulness being mindfulness of the body. and the fact that this culture is one that privileges the cognitive faculties, and our somatic connection, our emotional understanding and intelligence is really lacking. So I know that's true for me in many ways, and I see it as, you know, for in lesser or greater tendencies, we all have our imbalances in particular ways, but I think generally this culture sways towards the cognitive. And so the skill building of mindfulness, which is really should be mind, heart, bodyfulness, for a lot of us in this culture is really starting to learn to pay attention to the body. You know, the body is always in the present moment, whereas our mind is always jettisoning us into the future, or pulling us back to the past, and so much of this practice is aided by connecting with the body. So to build this capacity for present moment awareness, the body is probably the most profound tool, especially for those of us who don't have that facility.
Yeah, for sure. And I know one of the things that you really have talked a lot about in some of our conversations, but in general, is the sort of feminine in this practice and in the body, and some of the challenges around that as well. As women, we are particularly disembodied sometimes from our own understanding of our own body. I wonder if you can speak a little to that.
Yeah, you know, and in understanding that, I think there's a lot of there can be a lot of place for excluding people when we talk about just the feminine or the masculine. So just to say from the first that I like using yin and yang, because they don't immediately bring up connotations of male and female, or female and male, and help us to understand that these are principles. They're like dynamic, energetic principles, and not only about our gender or identities, but really it's this tension between, as I see it, the yang energy, which gets so emphasized in our culture, so the doing, active, persistent kind of forward energy, as opposed to this receptive, kind of restorative energy, and that they both have the other in them, just like the yin and yang symbol. So just because something is receptive, it doesn't mean that it's not alive, and just because something is active, it doesn't mean that it can't be gentle. So for me, it's sort of witnessing these imbalances in our culture, very evident in a place like New York City, and recognizing that a lot of meditation practice, mindfulness practice, is a rebalancing of energy, and what needs to be rebalanced for us as contemporary, especially Western culture, is emphasizing that receptive energy, and that it has a great power in it, and realizing that a lot of that has been tied to the feminine, and that there's a denigration or a degradation of that. So it's seen as kind of lazy or useless or dark or unnecessary in some way. And so to sort of lift that up and say that this is actually, even though it's not as active, it's a very powerful practice, energy, tendency, and something that needs to be cultivated to really be brought into our lives more.
You started talking a little bit there, like defining, but maybe you could give us a little bit more context for maybe, especially for me, who's not as well versed in this. What do you mean by receptive energy, and how to maybe define that or break that out for people who aren't as familiar, and to help us understand it a little bit better?
Yeah. In terms of mindfulness and practice, the way I see it, or the way that I've witnessed it, is actually paradoxical. So a lot of times, you know, we talk about this as a transformative practice, as really bringing a lot of change and good things to our lives, but it doesn't look like we're doing much.
Kind of sitting.
And so there's that's the power of the receptive. So this paradox that some of the biggest transformations actually come from allowing. And you see it, you know, even in, I think there are theories in physics that the sort of observational effect that when I'm I am not a scientist.
My father's the one who knows physics in our family. He tells me that my college education was a failure because I never took physics. So I'm the wrong person to ask about physics.
But I think there's a basic understanding that observing things changes them. So, mm-hmm. so even the observer changes the experiment. And I think that is something that is resonant in meditation practice. So it's incredible that just by witnessing our experience, and so on an emotional or mental level, mm-hmm. witnessing our distress or our discomfort or fear or anger or whatever arises in meditation has a transformative power. We're not actually having to do something. So we privilege that active doing energy, but this receptive energy of listening and being with our experience has a power as well. And so that's what we find in mindfulness practice. And if we can sort of reorient our tendencies to want to do, and there can be this real striving in meditation practice, try and get somewhere and do something and mm-hmm. get to a particular place, but it's actually the opposite. It's allowing whatever is unfolding and witnessing the transformation that happens from that.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, being at NYU, we're obviously with a lot of young people and a lot of young adults and students who find the act of being rather than doing quite difficult. Mm-hmm. And so we get a lot of students who are coming in with anxiety and depression and all sorts of things and looking for a different method. I know you also lead often young people in meditation and teaching, and I wonder what you see and how you sort of see the act of being manifesting in young people these days with this generation.
Yeah, it's funny. I was leading a young adult group last night, and a young man came up afterwards, and he's taking some intensive test for the Coast Guard or something. It's like hours and hours of testing. And he's been practicing for a few months now, and he was getting ready to take one of these tests and taking the train. It was a two-hour trip to school for him. Mm-hmm. And normally, he said he would have just been cramming until the very last second. And he decided to just relax on the train and to just look out the window and just enjoy himself. And when he got to the campus, he went for a walk and looked at the trees and looked at the water. And he was just amazed that he passed this test and he did well.
Yeah.
And that striving, and he prepared, he studied.
Right, of course.
It's not like he was just sort of leaving it up to
the elements.
Yeah, yeah. The feminine.
Yeah, right.
Or I feel like saying, yeah, it's all in the hands of God, I'm not even going to study in the first place.
Yeah.
He's taking that a little to a different extreme that probably wouldn't work.
Yeah, and finding that balance is so much of it. I feel like
yeah.
in this culture, these days we're really ricocheting between this overactivity and the striving and this
mm-hmm.
doing all the time. And then we swing violently back to a numbness
mm.
and sort of a passing out. And whether that's with substances or Netflix mm. videos,
mm-hmm.
there's this sort of need to kind of recover from all of that doing.
Right.
And finding sort of a balance that is a less extreme
mm.
so that there's an active knowing of what's necessary and needed in a situation, and there's a sense of relaxation in that process. So
mm-hmm.
I like to talk about it as a balance between being alert and relaxed rather than this hyperactivity and numbness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious. So, and I know Areka was telling me a little bit before how you care very much about a lot of certain social justice issues and definitely have an orientation towards social justice. So I'm curious, I guess it's a twofold question. One, how do you know then when it is time to act? Like, how do you make that decision that I've like sat with something, I feel like I'm comfortable with it, and I know that now actually an action is required? And then is the nature of that action different if you've really had a chance to sit with it first? Or is like qualitative, is there something different about what you do and how you go about doing it that you wouldn't have done otherwise? And you're like, oh, that this was a better approach just from start to finish.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I like to think so. I like the Brahma Viharas, or the sublime abodes, they're called. They're considered sort of these ideal states in Buddhism. They are traditionally, the Pali words, I'll say, are metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha, and they've been translated a lot as loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
I actually like a translation that this teacher, Martin Aylward, uses, and he calls them expressions of the heart. And he says that they're the heart that cares, the heart that responds, the heart that delights, and the heart that allows.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I really love that. And for me, you know, when I'm sort of in a dilemma about something, if I can't really be clear about whether... have real clarity and integrity and in a decision or an action, I sort of think about those four and think, you know, is my heart really caring in this moment? Or is it reactive? Is there a constriction at all? So there's a sense of, I think, openness and curiosity and kindness that are principles of mindfulness that show up in a caring heart. It's said that mindfulness, sati, can't arise without metta, or loving kindness, or caring. So that would be one thing. The other is this quality of responding appropriately, so this compassion. And that doesn't mean that it's kind of wishy-washy
right.
or mushy. It can be fierce compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the compassionate thing might be to slap someone's hand away from
right.
a fire. So that's another one. And, you know, oftentimes our responses are not only about sort of caring and compassion being challenges, but also joy, especially sympathetic joy.
Mm-hmm.
So joy in the joy of others. So there's a lot of like envy and jealousy that shows up in our decision making around, even in social justice circles, there's
sure.
a lot
right.
of backbiting and also pitting people and communities against each other, and so can we delight in the successes and joys of other people?
Right.
And then equanimity is really about this allowing. So it's not about allowing necessarily an injustice to happen. We might want to change that, but allowing my response to it and allowing that this is the situation that we found. Because a lot of times our discomfort and our challenge with things is because we actually don't want to see it. We don't want to deal with it, and so anger arises, or fear, or rejection. So allowing not only that this is what's happening in front of me, but I also am experiencing anger, or distress, or despair. The other side of it for me is to not to remember that despair is not the only thing that's going on. So for people who work in the social justice world, or who are really put in positions where they're constantly encountering oppression and injustice, I think that there need to be breaks to not only nourish self-care, but also to connect with things that bring joy and that allow us to care and have a compassionate response to our own experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's also moving into self-care. I think that's also a big thing that's been drawing people to sort of mainstream mindfulness, as you might call it. And I'm curious, you know, the conversation always happens where, like, people are in different camps, so to speak, about the mindfulness movement, if you want to call it. I think it's been dubbed all sorts of things in mainstream press. And for those of us who are sort of coming to it from the Dharma and Buddhist communities, there's a lot of discussion around it, around the sort of taking it out of or the sanitizing of it, as some people will talk about. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Many.
Yeah,
it's hard to say that I have a particular opinion about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see that there are conversations that need to continue. For me, there's the kind of mindfulness debate sometimes leaves out the fact that some people who are supposedly teaching the Dharma actually don't have a lot of root. They're not planted very deeply.
Yeah.
And then some people who are teaching mindfulness actually have very strong roots in a tradition. Mm-hmm. It's just that they are secularizing the voice, and mm-hmm. secular is, you know, we're going to use language here.
Yeah.
Language for complicated people. So
yeah.
That's a controversial word, but that's the best word I can use right now. So they take out, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of the poly. And are there problems with that? Yes, in some ways. You know, there is definitely a colonial or post-colonial aspect to that,
mm-hmm.
sort of denying the roots of this practices and to make it safe or comfortable for certain communities, and that can be very problematic. But there's also the question of, you know, can we provide a doorway for people to be in contact with teachers who actually have very strong roots in these traditions and can provide profound transformative practices and ways for people to access these Brahmaviharas, these you know, aspects of the heart that they may not be in touch with, and to get in touch with these capacity to be much more open and caring and connected. So it's, I'm reluctant to say one way or another that,
sure.
you know, sort of the mindfulness movement is bad or that it's good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends on who you're talking to and who's
right.
doing the teaching and what perspective they're teaching from. I will say that the mindfulness movement is unbearably white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that they're, it's largely inaccessible financially.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not, it doesn't seem to be having yet the same level or depth of conversation that maybe the Dharma communities are having about who has access to these teachings, who has the authority, who has really the perspective that includes all. And that seems to be just like baby steps in the mindfulness world right now.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like in the Buddhist world, like, you're seeing a lot of discussion of race and social justice and, you know, issues of diversity on many levels, but particularly around race in the last couple of years. And that is sort of then moving towards looking at the mindfulness movement in particular ways. So that it's like oddly connected, maybe forcing the conversation a little bit here and there. But I'm curious what you think about just the overall movement of where both the Dharma community is going and the mindfulness movement is going in terms of, you know, who they're attracting, what age groups we're talking about, what racial backgrounds, what class. I mean, you just touched upon it, but I do feel like it's going in a certain direction. I don't know if you feel the same at all.
I feel like it's going in a certain direction. I don't know what that direction
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
It's still so early, you
yeah.
know, and I'm so glad that we're in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about this, Rekha, that I think it's good that we're feeling the discomfort. In some ways, there's this naivete that if we're having these conversations, that's going to fix things.
No, yeah.
If we're having these conversations, we're going to.
If only just talking about things fix things.
Yeah, really. And that it's going to take a lot longer. I mean, these are
yeah.
communities and groups that have been intentionally segregated from each other for. Ever.
Yeah. yeah.
And how to start to create a shared language and a shared culture is going to be really difficult. And so, you know, that's what we do in this practice, is we learn to be with whatever is arising.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to see the discomfort people have with the discomfort that is caused by these conversations. So
that's interesting.
I feel like we're still at the very, very beginnings.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful because I see change already, and I think that what I'm witnessing in some communities is just the level of, again, naivete and lack of understanding of the depth that it's going to take, to the depth of work it's going to take to make changes,
mm-hmm.
and that it's not just about adding some brown people or queer people or women or to a panel or to a group or even to a teaching body, but it's really about culture change, and not everyone is up for culture change. That's not what they thought they were signing up for.
Yeah, I mean, we hear often people saying, but, you know, we're all supposed to be one, and that the Dharma is like no self, and that any kind of identity is, you know, against the idea of what we're trying to promote, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word, or just trying to embody. But the reality is we are these things. So the discomfort I find really interesting, because it's the same discomfort in greater culture just showing itself within these spiritual communities. And sometimes the resistance is stronger, which is interesting.
Because
too.
Of that
because
spiritual
of that.
Bypass.
Yeah, that bypass, exactly. And so talking about just sort of throwing some brown folks into like the mix of teachers and stuff, I know we've seen it at IMS that there have been more people of color becoming teachers, or at least going through the trainings, and more women and more queer people, more everybody. I wonder if you, the fact that we are having that, do you find that there's any impact on what's happening in those communities, or, you know, the conversations that are arising, or is it kind of just too early still?
You know, a place like IMS, the Insight Meditation Society, which is a residential retreat center in a fairly rural part of Western Massachusetts, it's a little bit more challenging because the culture itself is largely white. You're not going to see a lot of mixing except in silent retreats where there isn't an opportunity for culture change. So the faces at the front of the room can change, the offerings can reflect more inclusive voices, also in terms of how the teachings are shared. But I really see the real opportunity for change in what we call community Dharma centers, and in places where there is that diversity possibility, like in a place like New York City. I think in retreat centers and in centers where there isn't a lot of diversity in the community around them, people can do their own work for, you know, understanding their unconscious bias or environmental unconscious bias, and making a space more inclusive for the people who might come their way. But the opportunities for ongoing dialogue and connection and for real change in relationships, I think, is in places like New York, or and it doesn't even have to be a place as diverse as New York. It could be even places in the Midwest or in the South, where at least there's that opportunity for ongoing relationships. I really feel like diversity work is relationship work. That if we're not building ongoing relationships, then we won't really see much change.
It's like, at least anecdotally, seems very true to me, and the studies I've seen kind of in the field are how much less likely you are to harbor unconscious bias if you actually know someone who holds a certain identity. I'm curious, and this is like a little, this question may be a little irrelevant, but you were talking before about how the spaces that, like, how often mindfulness spaces are very white in the United States, and to me, part of what that's saying also is that there are a lot of people in the United States who grew up either without a religion or grew up in probably either a Jewish, a Catholic, or a Protestant home, and who are finding something in this mindfulness that maybe wasn't part of their upbringing. And now that they're being introduced to ideas that come from Eastern religions or from Buddhism and Hinduism, it's like this entirely new way of thinking about the world. So I'm curious, as someone who is Jewish and kind of grew up in that, if you could give us like one takeaway to take with us, or something you could distill into like a minute or two for a way to incorporate more mindfulness, what would you recommend?
You know, there's like this fetishization of the breath, I think, almost. Everyone like focuses on mindfulness of the breath, and it becomes like, well, that's what I need to do. But there's a reason why. Because the breath is always with us. it's internal, it's external, it's part of our sympathetic nervous system, our parasympathetic nervous system. It's something we can control, but it's also automatic. It's this incredible process that is so unique. And so for people to become conscious of their breathing is such a powerful, transformative possibility. And to sort of take that wherever you go. So even if you're not sitting down formally for a mindfulness practice on a daily basis, you know, can you on the subway just notice your breath? And can you, while you're waiting in line, notice the breath? And as part of this, and I'll talk about this tonight as well, challenge for this cognitive head-centered society is not to think about the breath, but to actually physically experience it. So as much as possible for people to connect with breathing as a felt sense experience in the body. I think that is very simple and portable and very powerful.
Thank you. Well, as I'm listening to a podcast on the way home from work, I'll maybe put some more thought into my breath. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you to Reka.
Of course, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We'd especially like to thank our guests, Sebane Selassie, for such an illuminating and interesting conversation this week. I'd also like to thank Liz Suatos, whose music is originally from the Of Many film, to Reka Prasad from The Office for joining us on the podcast for the first time. We will definitely have her back. For those of you who are excited to hear her voice, it is an amazing meditative voice, so get excited to have her back on future weeks. Also, thank you to Brian Young for editing, producing, and doing all things related to the episode. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and stay tuned for another episode coming next week. Thanks for listening.